Welcome to the Fisheries Podcast. In this fifth episode, I sit down with Jeffrey Day and talk about his work with the Sea Run Brook Trout Coalition. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Jeffrey Day. Jeff holds a bachelor's degree in human ecology from Connecticut College and a background in aquaculture, recreational, and commercial fisheries advocacy, fundraising, management, and technical and internet consulting as well. Jeff is a co-founder and executive director of the Sea Run Brook Trout Coalition. This is a science-based grassroots alliance of academics, fishery biologists, ecologists, non-governmental organizations, and private citizens whose goal is the preservation and restoration of wild coastal brook trout in their native range. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. I've been really looking forward to this.
So I grew up in a part of Iowa with no native trout populations, and I'm currently living and working in Kansas, a state with no native trout at all. So I'll kind of be playing more of a non-expert role today, and I'm excited to learn something new.
Have you seen trout in your travels and your fishery studies?
Yes, I've seen a little trout during an aquaculture class at Iowa State. We actually went up to one of the trout hatcheries in Iowa and squeezed the eggs out of some big rainbow trout.
Cool, cool. The brook trout in New England is one of a very small number of native char that are literally native to the area. The other would be the Arctic char. The brook trout is a beautiful little fish, really, really pretty. To some people, they're very unusual and they're very kind of uncommon looking. The little characteristic brookie that people sort of know if they fish New England or even the West too, but the pretty little characteristic brookie with the red fins and the spots and the blue and the yellow and the gorgeous colors. That fish has the ability to run to the sea. It's sort of a very special ability to do that. It's very much like a salmon that can run to the sea and come back. And in the process, it can change colors and it can change shape. And its health improves, its size improves, and its ability to reproduce also improves with all of these health benefits. So you've got effectively a super trout when these wild native fish have access to tidal estuaries and the sea below. So a sea run brook trout is virtually the same fish as a brook trout that people in New England grew up catching. And the brook trout can go to the sea and kind of turn into a different class of fish when it has access to the sea, which is very exciting to me and very exciting to biologists when they learn about this.
Your coalition focuses mainly just on brook trout. Is it only brook trout that exhibit this, or is that just the only native trout in your area?
Great question. Both rainbow trout, which is native to the West Coast, and the brown trout, which is native to Europe, both of them can go to the sea. Both of them respond very positively when they go to the sea, and they become larger and much more sought after by fishermen on the West Coast. A rainbow trout is known as a steelhead trout, and they coexist in many situations with an anadromous or diadromous salmon on the West Coast. And on the European coastline, the brown trout can also run to the sea, and any of the brown trout or the rainbow trout that are commonly found in New England came out of a hatchery truck. There might be a little bit of reproduction. We call those sort of wild fish, but they're not native to New England. It's a bit of a long story, but the fisheries managers invested very, very heavily in brown trout stocking because they were more robust. They grew faster. They didn't mind the warmer waters. And on Cape Cod, there was actually a blue ribbon fishery for sea run brown trout in the coastal access streams. And this was so phenomenal back in the sort of 60s and 70s. There are still people today that remember this and think about this and dream about these giant sea run brown trout that they would catch or even see in these rivers. So today that image still lingers. It was so powerful and was so exciting to fishermen that people still think when they think about sea run trout that in some cases they're thinking about brown trout. I entered the scene in the early 80s. A number of things had happened by then. Winding the clock back to the 1700s and the 1800s, early settlers would take a stream and dam it up for water power, for agriculture, or for fish ponds, or for whatever reason, there were multiple dams. These dams today in this century, many of them are sort of useless. They're just holding back a warm pond or a mill pond in a town or what have you. These dams are not performing any work. They're not generating power. No one's got a mill wheel turning there. But they do create these nice ponds, so people love their ponds. But the point is, in the 17th and 1800s, there were massive populations of anadromous fish, fish that access fresh and salt water, herring, the brook trout, Atlantic salmon, numerous other species, suckers of various things, would move in and out of these streams at different times and access these different habitats. And settlers would net these fish and benefit and survive on these fish. In fact, it is said by a number of people that the fish that the pilgrims in Plymouth survived on were very, very, very likely anadromous sea run brook trout. There may have been some Atlantic salmon in there, et cetera, but suffice it to say there were about a dozen species of fish that used these rivers, including sturgeon, that stopped using the rivers as the dams caused the rivers to be blocked for these migrations. So in many instances, these anadromous fish became extirpated. The fish themselves actually became limited or disappeared from these regions. Point is, development and settlement caused these rivers to be dammed, and these life histories of these fishes were severely limited by these dams. So one of those practices was the creation of these cranberry bogs on Cape Cod, these wonderful rivers that we've had literature descriptions of fishermen catching a bushel basket of sea run brook trout on a tide. And that's a really exciting thing for a fisherman to think about. And these were a pound up to 2 pounds. They're rarely 3 pound fish, but a bushel basket of brook trout. They're very, very delicious. Their meat is very, very fatty. The flesh is red. So this was a real prime food source and a wonderful sport for anglers in those days. These fish came in and out of these rivers. Well, you add the dams, you add the cranberry bogs, the fish would less frequently and less frequently be able to come into these rivers. So in the 1900s, the cranberry bogs started to use a much more sort of industrialized method of damming up the river to use the water to flood the bog, to use herbicides, to use pesticides, to use sand, and all of these things added more and more and more damage to the rivers, reduced the food availability, reduced the habitat where these fish could access the special spawning gravels that they needed, and effectively caused these fish to almost disappear. And yeah, they were known by a few anglers to still exist. They would reproduce as a smaller and a smaller size, so as a survival strategy. So they were there, but they weren't this robust, large, plentiful resource that we have documented in the 17 and 1800s. So the cranberry bogs put a hurt on that. In the 70s, the cranberry industry started to fall apart for a variety of reasons. And the anglers and fishermen in the area started to say, hey, we've got a river here that's soaked, incredibly degraded by these dams and these cranberry bogs. What would happen if we work to restore these rivers? It was a very groundbreaking thought in the 70s. And this one guy who's a Vietnam vet, he'd just come back from Vietnam, and he was working to sort of put something back in his life. And he organized people, and they had parties and passed out flyers and got all kinds of people involved in basically cleaning up the river to improve the fishing for brown trout that were stocked in the lower reaches of the river. So the brown trout actually did fairly well. Later on, a biologist came along and said, well, you know, we've got native brook trout in these systems. I think the brown trout are actually predating on the native brookies. And if we were to stop stocking the brown trout in these systems, maybe the native brookies would come back. Sure enough, he proved it. And we now have native brook trout in these systems that run to the sea and back. We had another sort of serendipitous event. A graduate student turned up and said, well, this is really unique here. Wouldn't it be interesting if we look genetically at what's going on here? Are these fish, can we tell what's going on with these fish if we look genetically at what they are? And it turns out he was able to prove that these fish were indeed genetically unique and not related in any way to the local hatchery strain of brook trout that are raised on Cape Cod and that are dumped in a lot of the ponds and streams. So This young student, his name was Brendan Annette, did this amazing genetic study. It went into a peer-reviewed paper, and it effectively became yet another rallying cry for anglers, like, we've got something very, very special here. We've got to do more about this. And, you know, what more can we learn? What more can we do? How can we help bring back these systems? Because so we've got, you know, four or five streams on Cape Cod that have these fish. Well, if you look at the coast of Massachusetts, there's and invariably hundreds of systems that once held sea run brook trout that don't anymore. The Charles River is a good example. The Merrimack River, the Parker River, you call the Connecticut River, any of the big rivers on the New England coast held these fish. Well, they're virtually extinct from all of these systems. It became obvious to myself and some anglers and scientists that if we took what we learned on Cape Cod and applied it to these other systems, we could bring back really an amazing resource and have some fun for anglers and people that are interested in this kind of thing. And as an ecologist and a biologist, I saw the benefit of the biodiversity, and that became very evident to other people as well. I'm not unique in seeing that, but it just turned me on to this. So the chap that started this all in the 70s, his name was Fran Smith, inspired the biologist Steve Hurley to stop stalking in that situation. That inspired Brendan Annette to do this genetic study. Those three things combined with a couple of other things, the fact that the cranberry industry was falling apart. There was a shortage of herring out in the ocean. And it turns out the herring use these systems. And if you restore these rivers for the brook trout, you also get herring. So a state agency turned up that was interested in supporting this river restoration work. And a number of additional sort of serendipitous events coalesced to create this boom of opportunity for sea-run brook trout, initially on Cape Cod and coast of Massachusetts. And now we're working extensively with other states and with hopes of making some very, very big strides in the state of Maine, some hopes of doing something in Rhode Island. We have a couple of conversations going on in Connecticut. But we're talking a multi-state opportunity to restore a very historic and unique fishery. Now, it's not for everybody. Not every river, not every stream is possible. But this is, in fact, true in many, many situations. And it inspires sort of a whole school of thought about restoration ecology that's useful in other situations as well. You know, but this has been a really wonderful little boom. And we created the coalition to sort of help get the word out. And, you know, this work, by the way, I have to credit the, you know, Fran Smith. Fran Smith was supported by Trout Unlimited local chapters and the regional council and Trout Unlimited national. So we had a tremendous amount of support for Fran to do what he was doing, because of course he had to learn about entomology and he had to learn about stream restoration. He had to learn about all these things, and he learned that effectively on his own, but in conjunction with biologists and, you know, a little money he raised from Trout Unlimited and experts he met through Trout Unlimited. That's sort of the beginning seed to this. And then, you know, the universities get involved, the state, the Department of Ecological Restoration, which is another state agency. And this was all really a very active bubbling stew when we came onto the scene in 2009 and said, this is really wonderful. We want to work with all you different sort of organizations and different moving pieces here and spread the word and raise money for you and help get this thing going more so into other states and other regions. And that's what became the forming of the coalition. The scientists needed money. We knew how to raise money. It was just another combination of things that sort of got together that worked for everybody. But the credit goes to Fran and the state and Trout Unlimited.
That was a wonderful recap of the whole history of the sea run brook trout and how the coalition came together. It said on your website that the goal is the preservation and restoration of these fish, and you touched on what led to their declines and everything. But how is your group working to improve their populations and restore these streams that they're found in?
Well, that gets into a very detailed description of what's going on in a river. And it's useful to talk about up in Maine when they had this massive forestry situation where they do these log drives. cut all these logs down, stack them up on the sides of rivers, and then when the ice would come out in the spring, they'd run the logs down the rivers. Well, those rivers were effectively straightened using, in addition to the fact that the running massive quantities of logs down these rivers every year would take the bends and the natural curves out of the river. They also used dynamite. They would drive bulldozers down these streams to create them so that they were more like a runway for these logs, so they could run these logs most efficiently downstream to the ponds, to the mills down below. That is destroying fish habitat in lots of ways. So the straightening of a river by an agricultural process is anathema to the texture and the sinuosity and the randomness of a river that fish co-evolved with through eons. And so a natural river has natural curves. There's all sorts of wood and fallen trees and all kinds of rocks and undercut banks and all kinds of interesting refugia where trout hang out and where food can gather and where they can be protected from predators. So a natural river has all this texture and sinuosity and variability that agricultural practices destroy. Same thing on a cranberry bog. They've taken a river and they've basically straightened that river. They've turned it into a ditch. There's no cover. There's no curves. There's no sinuosity. There's no variability. It's all sand on the bottom. There's no rocks. There's no gravel. There's no riffles. There's no place for the insects to hide. There's no place for the trout to hide. So what river restoration is, from our perspective, and there's a lot to this, is number one, removing the dams when you can, and number two, reinstalling or engineering the river back to emulate the original foul leg. So river restoration is basically taking these ditches and turning them back into lots and lots and lots of sinuosity and curves. And so a good example is the river restoration people will put woody structure into a stream, put a root ball here, put a log there, put an overhanging tree there, drop wood into the stream. Suffice it to say, river restoration is the act of adding back into a damaged river what was originally there. In some cases, it's boulders. In some cases, it's gravel. In some cases, it's wood. And in most cases, all of this stuff. It also includes literally digging the channel in such a way that it's got that sinuosity, or moving a channel over to where it's going over a series of natural springs where the original sort of farmer settlers moved the river to another place. So there's a lot to this about river restoration. So that is something that we support, but that's multiple millions of dollars of work to do that. You know, just the permitting alone is substantial, never mind the big, heavy equipment, and you're talking in some instances miles of stream, and you've got to bring in the wood and you've got to take out the sediment and all the, and never mind the dams, et cetera. That money to do that usually comes from a federal agency in combination with a local state agency, Department of Ecological Restoration here in Massachusetts. In some cases, NOAA, in some cases, other federal agencies. There's a conservation agency that supports this kind of work. These multiple million-dollar projects are funded by these federal or state dollars, and sometimes there's private money, sometimes there's additional sources of money that go in to help this kind of thing. We don't do that. We observe that. We talk about that. We learn from that, and we help people understand that, because none of this happens if you don't have a local community that says, we want to do this. Our job really, in a way, is to spread the word that this is possible. And just by the way, this works on any stream. If you can document cold enough water or a history of brook trout in a system that has no brook trout in it now, with this kind of engineering at a small scale, medium scale, large scale, or very large scale, can be done on a system anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, and to bring back the native population of fish that were there. So what we do on Cape Cod, this can be applied anywhere. So number one, enhancing the habitat by adding wood into a system in addition to the sinuosity is what we do. So this past Sunday on the Quashnet River, which is in Falmouth, Trout Unlimited met on their usual Sunday work day, and they planted 100 trees to help shade the river, to help stabilize the bank, This is a 100% volunteer-driven event where they're modifying the stream banks by putting in these native trees to replace the invasive species that have taken over these riverbanks, so that we'll have a sort of a much more native tree structure. So that's just one thing. Many times the crew is meeting on the river with a truck full of tree stumps or a truck full of fallen wood or trees that were cut on a house lot. And these limbs and branches and trunks of trees and root wads, et cetera, are carefully placed in an engineered way to improve the flow of the water, to give structure to the system, and to provide cover for the fish. And this happens, as I've said, every Sunday, all year long. And Fran and his volunteers, this is what they do to enhance the structure. And this is not just the Quashnut River. This is on the local river known as the Santuit. There's another river called Red Brook. As I said, this process, and the techniques and the methods and the enthusiasm has been contagious, and it's spreading into these other rivers as well.
So that brings me right into my next question that I had written down, was how many streams or stream sections has your coalition or these other parties been responsible for restoring?
Well, you start with the Mashpee River, and there's a beautiful trout stream there that hasn't been touched in probably over 100 years. There was some early restoration there. We don't have good records of what was going on there, but a very wealthy philanthropist bought a lot of this river as a private trout camp and went in and did modifications of some sort. That system today is very, very wild. It's federally owned and managed, and in part also by the state, in part, of course, by the Wampanoag Native American tribe. So the Mashpee is what we call a reference river, and that's effectively untouched in terms of a restoration. To the east of that is the Quashnut River. That's sort of where it started in the 70s with Fran Smith. To the west of that are the Childs and the Coonamesset rivers. Those two rivers are in varying stages of restoration. The Coonamesset just had a big dam taken out, and there was a big restoration million plus project phase completed this summer. There's another million plus phase being completed probably next summer, and another one after that. So these are reaches of the river as the river goes up. So that's the Coonamesset. The Childs is also undergoing restoration, but that's much, much, much more earlier on. And then further east of that, literally on the other side of the Cape Cod Canal, is another system called Red Brook. And Red Brook is where I've spent really most of my time and where we get a lot of our data. It's a very special location, Red Brook. We could do a whole hour just on Red Brook. It was owned by a very wealthy family in the 1800s, they effectively conserved it by buying up land around it. It was a very effectively famous fishing family, started fishing magazines and been on TV and, you know, newspapers, et cetera. And that family sort of lost interest in managing the system as that generation died out. And they called up Trout Unlimited and said, "Hey, we hear you're doing some great work on this river restoration. We think we've got a river that you might be interested in working on or owning or taking over, putting into conservation." And Red Brook is now managed by the trustees of the reservations. And that's a very, very special system there. And that's sort of the handful of big ones. Then there's the Cassett River and the Jones River and a project we're doing on Fresh Brook, and the North-South River Watershed Association has things going on in the North and South River, which are rivers that you cross over when you drive from Boston to the Cape. It looks like a big salt marsh. The rivers there once had Atlantic salmon in them, big herring runs, and sea run brook trout. And with the damming of these systems, the brook trout have almost petered out. We know firsthand that 20 minutes south of Boston, there's a beautiful population of wild brook trout. I'm not telling you where they are, because a couple of kids and a can of worms could put an end to them. But effectively, we have wild populations of brook trout almost anywhere you've got a highway crossing a salt marsh from Boston to Cape Cod, which is very exciting. And it gets even more exciting going north. I live in Newburyport. Go into a whole tangent about what's going on here in the Newburyport area. we're fairly concerned that all of the native brook trout in our region have been extirpated, and we're in the process of doing a coastwide survey to prove or disprove that theory. But as soon as you get north of Massachusetts, you get to New Hampshire, we're quite certain there's serum brook trout in various systems in New Hampshire. Then you get into Maine, and we're absolutely 100% positive that there's serum brook trout in many, many, many of the coastal access streams as you go up or down to the coast of Maine. They've all got brook trout in them. And if you take the streams out, if you improve the culverts, if you improve the habitat, you're going to have a much richer, much, much, much more interesting attraction. Some of these streams are going to be potentially world-class sea-run brook trout fisheries. So how many? So let's just say we got a half a dozen on the Cape, probably half a dozen going south, and then probably a half a dozen to a dozen in Rhode Island. And then Connecticut's another story I'm not going to get into, but easily a dozen known, understood, predictable fisheries on the south coast of Massachusetts, and then easily many dozen on the coast of Maine. And it just keeps getting better. There's a number of exciting rivers up there. Again, some of them will remain nameless, but there's a wonderful population of sea run brook trout up there, and great opportunities for restoration. You fix the rivers and the fish will come back. And not only do they come back, but they come back and you've got a highly sought after sport fishery. For the most part, this is catch and release, just by the way. Most of these systems are doing well on Cape Cod because they're limited catch and release, artificials only. So you can't fish with worms in there. You can't fish with treble hooks in there. But you can fish with a fly. Well, you can use lures, but you want to be very, very careful because of these fish. But you can't use bait very specifically in some of these systems, the Quashnet and Red Brook down on Cape Cod, just to make that point clear, that the state, through advocacy, anglers said, can we please restore these systems? Can we please have catch and release here? And the state effectively has done that, which is a really, 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 really great thing down there.
Do you see a day where you can maybe lift that catch and release status and you'll have sustaining populations, or are the systems just that degraded?
Well, sensitive is probably another word. We also have the specter of increasing temperatures, and we also have the specter of the fact that the salt environment, we have done virtually no habitat restoration in saltwater, and the saltwater habitat is highly degraded because you've got increased nitrogen, you've got decreased visibility, you've got less cover. The eelgrass in a lot of instances is gone. The trout that used to go down into these estuaries and hide in the eelgrass and feed on all this wonderful food that lived in the eelgrass, a lot of that is gone. The point there is the salt water is degraded too, and that's a much, much, much bigger job. We're talking about how to sort of work on that. Again, a subject for another podcast. As I said, my background is in shellfish, and if you plant, a gazillion oysters in these situations, there's a very active movement that the oysters will help clear the water, will help bring back the shellfish, it will add texture to the bottom. You've got shrimp and worms that live in the oyster clusters, and the shrimp and worms will attract other fish, which provide food and cover for the baby brook trout that get down there and for other forage fish. So you get a billion oysters downstream of some of these trout streams, you might have a really interesting increase. And it is possible that with, substantial luck, lots of money and time, talent and treasure, that we can substantially improve the estuary habitat, and that these fish might be coming back in much, much, much larger numbers. We don't know. All we know is we're kind of learning about this as time goes. It's possible. There are some systems in there where you can take fish. For instance, I believe it's the Mashpee River. There's a standard state of Massachusetts limit in there. You can take a number of fish, provided you have a license and provided you do it correctly. In the state, there are other systems, again, I'm not going to name them, where their populations are very, very sensitive, and there's no restrictions besides just the normal general brook trout regulations. We try to be very, very careful. about that and advocate that even if you're in a situation where it is not catch and release, that you practice catch and release, because we want these fish to come back. We want to have this for the future. We want to have this as a legacy for, you know, the next generation. And then we add, you know, this specter of warming water temperature. The more the temperature goes up in the air, that's going to affect groundwater. The water in the ground coming out of the springs is currently in the 50s, pretty much year round, and maybe in the 60s, maybe as high as 65, 68, 70. If it's much higher than that, it's not really that friendly for brook trout. But these systems, Red Brook and the Quashnet and the Mashpee and the Coonamess and the Childs, all have real active spring feeds that keep the water temperatures warm in the winter in the 50s and cold in the summer in the 50s, which is perfect for brook trout. And as the temperatures increase, those numbers are going to go up, and that's going to potentially limit the amount of habitat that brook trout have access to, and that's going to put a hurt on those populations. So we want to be mindful of that, and I want to encourage people to think about all of these things when they fish for, you know, native wild brook trout. But I'm a big fan of catch and release in this situation. And that's not to say taking a fish now and then is against the rules. We just want people to be very, very mindful and sensitive to the delicacy of the habitat and the delicacy of these special fish.
So your organization also works with and funds some research projects on these fish. Could you just highlight some of those projects that you're involved with?
Well, the sort of the number one thing is we do pit tagging, and we work with a biologist to electrofish a stream every spring and fall, and fish above a certain size are implanted with a pit tag, which is a passive integrated transponder RFID device, effectively the size of a grain of rice. It's inserted with a hypodermic syringe. Many of these rivers are outfitted with solar-powered antennas that pick up a signal when these tagged fish move through the antenna. So we get movement on these fish. So each fish has a unique ID, so we know that number 336112 hit that antenna, you know, in March and in May and in June, and then didn't until the fall, so we can infer where the fish was, et cetera. And so this is thousands and thousands of fish that we've tagged over the last decade plus in multiple streams, Red Brook and Quashnet and several of these others. So we support that both by providing manpower to help with the process, but we also raise money for and buy solar panels, batteries, pit tags, the hardware. Sometimes some of the biologist equipment has failed and we replace that. I mean, the state supports this effort in a big, big way, but our money helps the state do more with their limited resources. So that research is something that we are absolutely committed to funding and supporting in a number of ways. And it goes into, we have anglers now that carry pit wands. So when an angler catches a fish, he or she can wand a fish, write down, record the number of the fish that was tagged, measure the fish, and return the fish, and add more data to the current data set on that particular fish. We also have anglers who are licensed by the state to actually insert these pit tags if they catch a fish that doesn't have a tag to add more, again, more data into the situation. So pit tagging is like the big one. We also do effectively population surveys. Here on the North Shore of Massachusetts, I work with a local Trout Unlimited chapter, and we're funded to do a study to see if we can determine if there are any brook trout in any of the streams here on the North Shore. I use a new emerging technology called eDNA, environmental DNA, where from a liter of water that I send up to a lab in Maine, they can tell me if there's shed DNA in that water from brook trout. So I can tell if a stream, for a, you know, small price and a little bit of effort, I can tell if a stream has brook trout DNA in it. I know that the state doesn't stock here, so we can tell if there's brook trout DNA in a system, that there's brook trout in that system. That's a very powerful way to do a sort of a coastwide survey. So we're sort of piloting that here in Massachusetts. We hope to be doing more of that in Maine. That's another research. We also do water chemistry studies in conjunction with a partner on the Cape. We also do this interesting thing called temperature monitoring. Brook trout like this sort of narrow temperature range. Obviously, you know, they're happy in cold water. Well, as soon as the water gets above sort of 68 for a few days in the summer or a couple of weeks in the summer, it's not that friendly for brook trout. Well, we can, for $50, put a temperature recording monitor called a hobo in a brook and get a 15-minute, every 15-minute picture of the temperature of that system. So we can see if there's cold water in that system and if the cold water sustains itself at good enough temperatures during the summer. Well, if we put a temperature monitor at every 100 meters or so, we can start to observe, well, gee, look at this. We've got a warm water pulse here and then a cold water pulse here. Well, that must mean that we've probably got a dam or an obstruction that's causing warm water or water to warm unnaturally, and we've got a spring that's causing that warm water to cool. So we're doing that here in Massachusetts. I learned this because this is what proved to the biologist that red brook would be a good candidate for stream restoration, because through the placement of these stream temperature monitors, they could see these wonderful, wonderful cold water areas, and then they could see where there was a dam or a flume or a culvert or obstruction or something that was causing the water to back up and warm in the summer. It's also a good, you know, justification for tree planting. You can bring the temperature down of a system. If you've got warm water that otherwise would be naturally cold in the summer, plant some trees in there, you're going to have some nice shade, and that might create more habitat for those brook trout. So we do the pit tagging. There was a project that we did with sonic tagging, which is another type of tagging that we can observe the fish when they move around out in the salt water. The temperature monitoring, we support the electrofishing. We do this water chemistry work. There's a longer sort of scale entomological project that we're very, very interested in. You know, what do these fish eat? Are there sufficient quantities of stoneflies and caddisflies and mayflies and other invertebrate in these systems? Well, you can't get to the bottom of that without a real serious entomological study every couple of years. That's another thing that we fund. So this sort of goes on and on and on. I spent a lot of time studying the literature because there are hints in old literature that there were brook trout in this system, or there was a fishing club in this location, or that kind of thing. That's what we do, but we also are asked to speak, to spread this word, because trout unlimited chapters, fishermen's organizations, land trusts, other organizations invite members of the coalition, myself and other people, to come and do a slideshow, a presentation, get out in the field, look at some systems, maybe do some analyses, maybe go fishing. We've done a lot of population surveys with flies and fly rods and things of that sort. So that's kind of fun to get invited fishing and learn about what's going on. We do a lot of sort of reconnaissance work using Google Earth and old maps and stuff like that. So there's a lot of different literacies called for. It's a lot of fun, a lot of different disciplines. So that's the kind of research that we do. In an ideal world, we'd love to have a sort of a university scale genetic study going on, because we know so much about these fish, but we don't know much about them genetically. We don't know the size of these populations. There's some question as to whether the ability to survive in the saltwater is genetic. We think that we've effectively ruled that out, but I don't believe that's ever been technically proven from a genetic perspective. I believe it's been proven in other ways. And there's all these questions about, from a genetic perspective, what's going on with these fish. Will a fish that goes to sea that has a higher growth rate than other fish pass that genetic tendency for high growth down to its progeny? We don't know that. We had a fish last year turn up that was 14 inches that had grown about 4 inches in a single season. And we could tell from the pit tag data that this fish had spent the majority of the winter in the salt water. So this is very clearly an off the charts high growth rate for a fish of that size that we infer was able to grow that fast
because of the access of to food down in the salt water. And it's really exciting to see that. We wouldn't know that had we not had the pit tagging in place, not had the electrofishing in place, not been in the field when this happened, didn't have photographers and videographers there when this happened. So we got all this wonderful data, and the volunteers that were there learned this stuff firsthand. We don't know if that fish is genetically different and that that particular fish passed on its genes to a population of superfish or not. We've got fin clips, but we don't have the dollars and the graduate students to apply to this to actually start answering those questions. And we have hopes and conversations with different organizations and universities and other partners and funders, et cetera, to try to make that happen. But as yet, we're still looking. There's probably a dozen more large-scale questions that we haven't even begun to ask about these fish that, given the right science, we could start asking and getting some interesting answers.
Well, I definitely learned a lot more about sea run brook trout than I'd ever imagined I could know before talking to you. but now we're down to the final five questions that I have.
Final five. All right.
Yeah, and this is a group of five questions that I ask each of the expert guests that come on the show. And we start real simple. And I think I have an idea how this is going to go. But what is your favorite fish?
Well, brook trout, of course. But you're asking the wrong guy. I also love striped bass. I also love bluefish. I grew up as a kid, believe it or not, I was a commercial fisherman as a kid, and we caught striped bass and paid a few bills from selling striped bass in the back doors of restaurants and fish markets. So I love a striped bass. I don't like to eat them anymore. I love catching them. I love seeing them. One of my favorite is the most important fish in the sea, the pogie, also known as the menhaden. I'm kind of limited because I'm the brook trout guy, but many, many, many favorite fish. I can't stop at one.
And then what is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
That's easy, but it's far before the career. It's lying on my belly on a brook trout stream near my home in Paxton, Massachusetts in the 60s, lying on my belly looking at these jewels, these fish swimming in this crystal, crystal clear water, inches from my nose, not even knowing that they were brook trout and just falling in love with these beautiful, majestic, marvelously colored up fish on a fall afternoon with the colors in the leaves. That remains probably the most favorite memory I have of many, 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 many favorite memories.
I think you did a pretty good job of painting the picture there, and I can just see that. And if anyone doesn't know what brook trout look like, just do a quick Google search, and they're a very beautiful fish.
Thanks. They are.
Perhaps you're already in it, but what is your dream job or dream location to work at?
My ideal job would be exactly what I'm doing with a substantial budget and a crew. And I already have a marvelous crew, but we're all volunteer. The ideal job would be when the big checks start rolling in.
Well, my next question just happens to be, if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Well, we really want to look at the genetics of what's going on with these fish. And we have drawers full of dried fin clips. And each one of these fin clips has a number from the pit tag of the fish. So we have a history of this particular fish, how long it lived, how fast it grew, where it was, if it spent a lot of time in the salt water or not. So that's a lifetime of work to really sort of understand this population from a behavioral perspective, from a sort of a biological, ecological perspective, and from a genetic perspective. And the genetic tools keep getting better and better and better. So we can now, in theory, look with much greater sort of granularity or resolution as to what's going on with these fish. And I get to have the joy and the fun and the stimulation of working with brook trout people around the country. And Leestown, West Virginia, I believe is a location. There's a big sort of research center down there that studies brook trout and genetics of brook trout, in part because they've got a lot of funding from mine remediation money down there. Acid water from mine waste and drainage is a big negative factor on the health of brook trout in the south. If you can remediate that acid, you've got a much better situation. Well, they've done a lot of studies and a lot of understanding, done a lot of genetics work down south because of that source of money and the depth of commitment of, I believe it's Leestown, USGS, and a number of other sort of institutions that focus on the brook trout. I'd like to do effectively the same thing up here, you know, on Cape Cod and in Maine, to put the salter brook trout on the map, very much like Leestown has put the southern brook trout on the map, the academic map down there. But it's not about studies or published papers or anything. It's really about understanding these fish so that we can leverage what we learn so that we can have more fish. So that's a kind of a takeaway. I have a couple of takeaways I want to, but significant takeaway I want to leave you with is that this isn't really about me. This isn't about me catching more fish or about putting a trophy on the wall or bringing home a brace of fish for dinner. Although all that is absolutely, you know, part of what it's like to be a sportsman, what it's part to be an angler, and a wonderful way to celebrate these fish or any fish. What is interesting to me is figuring out a way to put more fish back. And those fish need to be aboriginal, the fish from the particular landscape where you're working. I don't want to put more brown trout in our systems. That's fine. That's nice. Someone else can do that. In fact, the brown trout is a great candidate for some of these highly degraded systems. And there's a wonderful series of fisheries here in Massachusetts that are stocked brown trout, in some instances, possibly even nativized, reproducing brown trout. I want to figure out and have other people naturally have the ability to put more native fish back into the brooks and streams. So increasing the habitat for herring is very interesting to me. Increasing habitat for brook trout is very interesting to me. So you fix a river and then you've got hundreds of thousands or millions of fish coming back. That is what drives me, because that brings more fish, that brings the birds, that brings the seals, that feeds the sharks, that's the whole web of life, that brings the anglers, that brings the turtles, that the fish die and it feeds the invertebrates. It's that whole web of life is the thing that's exciting and stimulating to me.
You kind of touched on some of your takeaway points. And my final question is, if there is one point or principle that you could have programmed into everybody's head, what would it be?
Sportsmen as a whole have a debt to our environment. We've been abusing and degrading and exploiting and living off the land in so many ways and destroying the land in so many ways. We owe a debt to helping the land, the biosphere, the biodiversity, the soil itself to recover. And, you know, if that's helping to remediate acid rain, or if that's helping to, you know, improve the streams, if that has to be about fisheries, all of that stuff, I suppose that's the takeaway that I want people to have embedded in all the, you know, the people that are listening out there. That would be the wonderful, wonderful thing. And then I got a final takeaway for you, but you probably have a couple of more questions you want to ask. I don't know.
Nope. That was the end of my question. All we have left is just to wrap it up. So
the wrap up here. So I'm a big fan of Lee and Joan Wolf. Joan Wolf was Lee Wolf's wife, and she herself is an amazing angler and sort of doyen of fly fishing. She's on the board of directors of the American Museum of Fly Fishing, and a wonderful woman. I hope I get a chance to meet her someday, or maybe interview her by phone. Joan, I'll leave you with Joan Wolf's four stages of an angler. She says is, you know, first stage is about numbers, you know, how many fish you caught, whatever. Second stage, it's about catching the biggest. You know, you want to, instead of catching that 4-inch brook trout, you want to catch a 12-inch or a 15 or a 20-inch brook trout. Stage three, says Wolf, it's about challenging yourself, you know, catching even more difficult fish, you know, catching a permit, expanding your skills and working with flies, fly fishing rather than bait fishing or what have you. So stage three is about challenging yourself to do more learning, more physical challenges, more mental challenges. And stage four is giving back to the sport. So for Joan, stage four was defining the fly cast so that anybody can master it. And Joan is a master fly caster, was a very young woman when she broke all kinds of records in the 30s and 40s and 50s before she met Lee. So stage four is, you know, about giving back to the sport. For me, stage four is about putting more fish back. And maybe that is even a stage five. Can we, utilizing science and math and engineering and history and all kinds of different policy and advocacy and education, you know, internet, website, Facebook and stuff like that, can we use these tools to leverage our behavior to change people, to figure out a way to put more fish back in the brooks, in the ponds, in the streams, ideally native fish, but really any kind of fish is great if you can, you know, enhance a habitat with enough food and enough cover, enough, you know, the water's cleaner, the water's colder. What can we do to enhance the environment to enable more biodiversity and more fish? So that's what I want to leave you with there.
Well, Jeff, thank you for coming on the podcast today. I definitely learned a lot, and I'm sure most of the listeners did as well. If people want to find out more about your coalition or to just get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Sure. Great question. So crunbrookie.org, www.crunbrookie.org on the web. We also have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/srbtc.org. I'm in Newburyport. We spent a lot of time on the Cape. We've got a sort of a chapter going on down there that's developing in its own right, which is a very exciting thing. We've also got collaborations with organizations in Maine, primarily this one very special organization called the Downy Salmon Federation, which you probably should get to know if you don't already. They're running a conservation hatchery, one of one in the country. And they are working day and night to bring back wild native Atlantic salmon. Basically, crunbrookie.org, and we can direct you to some of these other organizations if you're interested. And if you're at all on Cape Cod, if you aren't a member of Trout Unlimited, wherever you are, become a member of Trout Unlimited. A lot of this stuff is where we learned about restoration, about sinuosity, about wood, etc. On the Cape, there's several different Trout Unlimited chapters that are working on restoration, and you can go and volunteer there yourself, or get to know some of the chapter members, and they'll take you fishing and show you where these fish are and how to catch these marvelous fish.
And the website crunbrookie.org has membership information as well as some items under the shop tab. So I'd suggest you check that out if you're interested in supporting Jeff and his organization. And it is a 501c3 organization, so donations are tax deductible.
That is correct.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Tune in next week when I'll have Brandon Peoples on to talk about some of the projects he has going on at Clemson University. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 5th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, we owe it to sportsmen and scientists to restore the aquatic system that we have helped degrade.